HanselMinutes.com. It's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 96, recorded live Friday, January 11th, 2008. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik RED Controls, the most comprehensive suite of components for Windows Forms and ASP.NET web applications. Online at www.telerik.com. In this episode, Scott talks F-sharp with DevExpress developer Dustin Campbell.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman, and this is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'm sitting here in the hallowed halls of the Kalahari Resort in Sandusky, Ohio, halfway between Toledo and Cleveland. I'm sitting here in the middle of the CodeMash conference with Dustin Campbell, famed developer of DevExpress and arch nemesis of Mark Miller. How are you, Dustin?
I'm doing great, man.
Now, yesterday, you gave a fantastic talk on F-sharp that I thought was really interesting.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate that.
One of the things that really struck me about your talk was that you said, this is an immense language, and you said that at least three times. And you had this diagram up on the screen. I know that we're on a podcast, so I can't show people the diagram. Maybe I'll blog about it. But explain to me these different modalities that F-sharp kind of encompasses.
Well, F-sharp, where some programming paradigms can be, you can work with different programming paradigms in different languages. F-sharp actually fully embraces three. So functional programming, object-oriented programming, and imperative. All right. Now, what goes along with that is a massive number of features. So you've got your functional programming features, which are fully in there, like automatic generalization and extreme type inference. But then you've got object-oriented features that are almost, some of these are unique to F-sharp. And on top of that, things like, you know, compiling to mono and standalone executables and all those sorts of things that are just like, there's a lot of features in this language. It's a huge, huge thing.
You keep using really enthusiastic adjectives. You keep using things like immense and extreme. You said extreme type inference. That seems like the X Games. What is an example of an extreme type inference? I mean, you're pulling information from as much context as you can,
mm-hmm.
from other places. I mean, where can you pull this context from?
Well, for example, the operators that are being used, functions that are being used that within your code, within the body of another function, those might have some type annotations. But the F-sharp compiler can also say, you know what, I'm not sure what these types are, but I can make them generic. I know that I can make these generic types for you. So you might declare a function, and it might not actually say, hey, this parameter is going to be an int. It's going to say, you know what, this is going to be the generic type parameter A, that sort of thing.
Now, when you say generic, I mean, I think generic, I think, you know, angle bracket generics like
sure.
list of int. Is that the kind of generic that we're talking
exactly
about?
Exactly that kind of generic, but at a function level where your function's actually declaring generics into itself, that some of its parameters will have generic type parameters.
So it's saying that I don't know enough that this is an int or a long, but I know that it's going to be some kind of a type, so
mm-hmm.
I'll just loosen up a little bit and allow those types to go through.
Exactly.
Now, can you provide it with hints?
Yes. You can apply, you can add your own type annotations if you need to, and sometimes when you're writing library code, if you're writing a public API, that might be nice. Maybe if you're giving out the source code and, you know, people want to look at this, they can see what the types are. But generally, as I'm writing code, I can write it very succinctly, not use types, and maybe like 97% of the time, it just gets what I want. It gets
so
what I want.
Is this a dynamic language? I mean, people think of dynamic languages as moving types in a very liquid form, just kind of from here to there.
No, it's not a dynamic language. It's very strongly, very statically typed. But the type inference allows you to write in a way that feels like that kind of fluid dynamic language. If I declare a variable and the compiler infers a type for that variable, I can't now go and set that variable to another value of a different type.
You can't change it to a value of another type. Like if I go and say let I equals zero, I can't go let I equals string.
Well,
or
yes
I can't
and no.
change I at all.
You can't change I, but there are scoping rules within F sharp, so you can't actually redeclare I. Okay, but that's actually a new I. It's
okay,
not the same
okay,
I.
So
I'm not actually declaring. I'm not actually changing the same value, so the original variable I
right.
to a new type. I'm declaring a new variable I, and any if you had a function say that. that worked with I, if you had a function that that consumed I, the original I, that function would still continue to use the original I with the original type. But you'd now, if you, and if you redeclare I to a new type, that I now exists for the rest of the scope.
Okay, so at this point, we've lost 90% of our listeners. So let me see if I can understand, because I'm struggling to understand this as much as I'm sure some of the listeners are. So if I go and I say let, this is like a, like what I would think of as dim. I mean, I'm basically just making a declaration.
Sure.
Let I equals zero. And I'm saying that there is a name now that is bound to the value zero, such that when I refer to I later, I'm really referring to zero, but I'm referring to it with a friendly name.
Yes.
Okay. Did I get that right? Now, I can't say I equals two later.
No.
That seems like a very big mental change. I mean, you're saying that there's really no variables. It feels like there's only constants.
There's not that they're constant. In fact, it's just that they're variables, but they're immutable. Okay. So they can't be changed unless you declare that variable differently. For example, you could say let mutable I equal zero. And now you could then use an assignment operator to change that I. So it is a variable. It's just by default in F-sharp, all variables are immutable. They cannot change.
Mm, okay, and that sounds like a hassle.
It is kind of a hassle if you want to program in that, if you're used to that old imperative style of programming that we've been indoctrinated with since Fortran.
Right.
So if that's what makes you comfortable, then it will feel a bit of a hassle at first.
Okay.
But once you get used to it, once you get used to the idioms of a more functional style of programming, it becomes very natural.
So there's an interesting contrast here. You're pointing out very explicitly that there's the imperative style of programming, what you refer to as the Fortran style, and then there's the functional style, which is, I assume, from the Lisp world.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, I think there are a lot of people out there, a lot of people, whether it be of my generation or younger, who just never learned Lisp in college. They skipped that part because imperative programming has been so fundamental to everything that we've done. Can you talk a little bit about those differences? I mean, what really is the difference between functional programming and imperative programming?
Well, you made a good point that really it comes from Lisp, right? Really, it's, if you think about it, the two oldest programming languages in widespread use, which would be Fortran and Lisp, are really kind of the mother languages, right? Lisp being the mother language of functional programming, Fortran being the mother language of what became C, and then, you know, C-based languages like Java and C-sharp and all of our imperative languages. But what makes these languages different is that Lisp, while it was trying to solve math problems, it would start from the mathematical symbols. That's where it started, and then it moved downwards and added abstractions below it. Whereas Fortran started kind of with the numbers, and it grew upwards, added abstractions on top. And that's what we live with today. What really makes these, I think the words that the kind of buzzwords, so I hate using them in one sense, but the words that really just kind of describe what these are doing is that Lisp is more of a declarative style, where you're saying, or a functional programming language, get away from Lisp, say just the functional programming languages in general allow you to write things in a more declarative way, saying, this is what I want done, as opposed to an imperative style, which is more like a recipe, like you're a chef and you've got a list of instructions that you want to follow step by step, and say, this is how I want this done. This is exactly what I want the processor to do, the steps that I want you to go through to do it. And in a functional programming language, you do the opposite. You say, this is what I want you to do, and I really don't care how it happens.
Okay, so that's really good description. I'm going to paraphrase that because you kind of blown my mind there. So a functional programming environment is where you're basically saying that, you know, here's the state of affairs as I know them initially.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a description of, what my ultimate goal is. Go ahead and get on that. Work that out. Start. And not concerned if it's recursion or if it's a big old loop or whatever. Just make it happen and call me when it's done.
Yes.
And then in the imperative format, we start out with some beginning state, as we did before, but then we say very, very explicitly all of the state changes that we're going to go through in order to get something done, and it's completely up to us to decide how that gets done. And sometimes that how is outside of the scope of the problem itself, and we may not know the best way to do that. You had a recursive function add that took X and Y and then just added one and returned. And you wrote it in C-sharp and then you tried to add like 38,000.
Yeah.
One plus one plus one, and you recursed, and you blew the stack.
Very nasty exception to have happen.
And not only did you blow the stack, but you took a long time to do it, because the stack got really big. I mean, there was a huge 37,000 deep stack, but when you did it in F sharp, you wrote the basically what I perceived to be the same recursion, but it happened instantly,
yes.
And it didn't blow the stack. Was there no stack? Is there no spoon?
Is there no spoon? There was no the way F sharp compiler took a look at that bit of recursive code, it could see that the very last thing that was done by the function was to call itself. And it's called tail recursion. That's what the tail means. It means it's the very last thing that happens. And it took that and it was able to say, well, if all I'm going to do is go back to the front of this function again, then all that I need to do is turn this into a while loop. And that's what happened then in the talk, in the session. We brought up Reflector and we took a look at the C-sharp code compiled exactly as I'd written it. You know, when we looked at it with Reflector, and then we looked at the F-sharp code in using the C-sharp decompiler, and we saw that while loop. And so it really happened almost instantaneously because it was just increments and decrements within a while loop.
Now,
loop.
Is that a feature of the language or a feature of the compiler? I mean, the C-sharp compiler is getting very, very smart. There's a lot more method inlining and some tail call optimization in the jitter of the CLR, but apparently not enough to have spotted that issue and fixed it.
Sure.
So is this a feature of the language in the sense that kind of optimization has been brought up into the language spec and said that this is something that we'll handle, this is an optimization that's appropriate, or is this just that the F-sharp compiler is just so smart?
Well, it is more of a language thing. Because functional programming in the F-sharp language is so built upon recursion, it's such a natural fixture, an idiom that's used, that it really is part of the language. So even if you do things that you would think, well, this isn't a tail recursive situation, where you do co-recursion, what's called co-recursion, where you have one function that calls another function and that function calls the first function and back and forth to solve a problem. F-sharp will still handle that using IL instructions appropriate. It'll manage to get that so that it won't stack overflow. So it's really part of the language. It's trying very hard. You know, you can get there. You can get there and get a stack overflow. But if you follow kind of these functional programming idioms of tail recursion, that sort of thing, F-sharp will pick that up for you and allow you to do these sort of things without overflows.
Now, often when I'm writing C-sharp code or what I would think of as classic imperative .NET languages, I find myself thinking about how things are going to look at runtime. I find myself thinking, well, here's where I'll be in the stack at this point, and you know, maybe recursion is appropriate here. But I don't think recursion is something that unless you're calling find control, I don't think that Joe, a .NET developer, necessarily pulls recursion out of his pocket every 5 minutes. But it seems like with a functional programming language like F#, where you can't change a variable, then you would need to use recursion because you had to put stuff somewhere.
Yes. So you need to modify that variable. If you're, for example, with add, the way it works, we have two parameters, x and y. And when we recurse, we call add again, decrementing x and incrementing y. So we call it with one less and one more on each parameter. And by the time we get when x equals 0, then we know that y is the final result. And that's kind of how recursion works. You're going to take and accumulate a value at the end. And when things are immutable like that, you're exactly right. So in functional programming and in F#, one of the structures that's used most often is a list, a singly linked list. And that's a recursive data structure. And it has to be dealt with using recursion. It has to be, when you operate on it, you have to use recursion to build up new lists, to operate on a list. You manipulate, your manipulations on the original list, produce a new list, and you build that up through recursion using the same kind of technique where you have a parameter that's going to accumulate the result.
That's interesting. So a list is not a system.collections.list. This is an F-sharp specific thing. It's not a list that I iterate over. I'm recursing over it. Can I for loop over these lists?
F-sharp provides some structures that look like that, but that's not what's happening.
Okay.
Yeah. Because an F-sharp list is a beautiful structure, really, because it's a recursive structure where a list is really simply just a head and a tail. It's like a value and then the rest of the list. But that rest of the list is another list with a value, and the rest of the list. And so on, all the way down to the very end, and where there's a little marker called the empty list that ends it.
And see, this is interesting. I keep thinking about computer science class because you're talking about things that, I mean, really, honestly, when was the last time a C-sharp programmer who wasn't in academia had to whip out a singly linked list?
Yeah.
It just doesn't, I mean, it happens, and I'm sure that they'll be, I'll get email from listeners that'll say, like, hey, man, I do singly linked lists all the time. But when you look in system.collection, that wasn't the first thing that, doubly linked lists and singly linked lists were not the first things that leap out of the collections. It's mostly just, here's a chunk of memory, and here's how we're going to think about it.
Sure. But today in programming in C-sharp 3, we don't use a singly linked list per se. We use IEnumerable of T, which is essentially the same kind of thing.
Point.
It's an iteration structure that is used in link in a very similar way to the way that an F-sharp list would be used.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that because my next question was going to be, has F-sharp kind of come out of nowhere, and because it included non-functional paradigms? Because we at the beginning of the talk here, I was asking you about, you threw up this diagram that said functional and object-oriented and imperative, and then you drew this kind of circle around them all and said, well, F-sharp really encompasses all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I personally feel has made functional programming languages less applicable to me in my life was that the problems I solved didn't feel like classical functional problems. But this may be one of the most accessible languages for the .NET developer because I can do things in the old way, but put my toe in the pool, I guess, if I'm not quite ready to jump in, you know, cannonball style. I want to just feel around, and I could move from paradigm to paradigm. And I wonder, if this is, are there other languages that are that inclusive, that broad reaching in their style, that they would let you move kind of comfortably from OO to functional to imperative?
There are others, but I'm not finding them.
Yeah,
I'm really not. The F sharp for me is the one that's really spoken to me. It really makes this the most clear, especially with functional programming. If you go to you know, for example, if you want to try and learn functional programming, you go to a language like Haskell.
Right, that's what I learned in college.
It's a different thing, right?
Yeah.
It's a very different thing.
Oh, yeah, it was
and
weird.
And there are certain things that are forced upon you, whereas in F-sharp, like we said earlier, yes, you can. Your variables are immutable by default, but it's fine to go ahead and declare a mutable value as well because F-sharp does embrace imperative programming. It allows you to program in an imperative style as well if that's what's comfortable to you.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, as you get more comfortable with a language, you'll do that less, but you won't fall back so much on that kind of older style of thinking that's more comfortable to you.
It seems a very inclusive language. You know, we had Robert Pickering on the show who wrote an F-sharp book a couple of months ago, and he pointed out that one of the things that was attracted to him that it allowed you to have significant white space.
Yes.
Or not.
Yes.
And that or not part was really interesting because it's unusual for me, I would think, that a language could provide a choice like that. Languages are always so dogmatic, you know.
Sure.
Here's how we do things in Scott Sharp. And, you know, if you don't like that, well, fooey on you. But here's a language that said that here's a religious issue that, you know, it's almost like don't eat pork. But if you do, here are some wonderful recipes.
And it's that way in object-oriented programming, too, with F-sharp, I'm finding. As I do OOP-style code in F-sharp, I'm writing design patterns. I'm coding them in very different ways than I would have in a language like Java or C-sharp. For example, you just made a really good example of giving you the options there, but not saying, here's what you have to do.
Mm-hmm.
F-sharp supports implementation inheritance, right? But implementation inheritance has some baggage and overhead associated with it. When you descend from a class, you're essentially making a more complex object a lot of the times. And so implementation inheritance can be the cause of some problems in object models that become brittle, you know, objects, models become brittle and that sort of thing. So F-sharp allows you to do implementation inheritance, but it downplays it. It gives you another language feature called object expressions, which allow you to take, say, an abstract class or an interface and just instantiate it, giving it its members, giving it the implementations that you want at the time that you instantiate it. So instead of actually having to go out and declare something and declare some descendant or implementer of something, you can just construct it right there.
So this is interesting because it's not a language that is looking down on you if you try to do something. It's saying that this is, you can do this, and rather than making you feel guilty about it, they simply provide an alternative method that if you find more attractive, we would encourage you to use. So it seems like it's a very friendly language.
It's a very friendly language, but it's also, it's a research language. So when I said it was immense, part of that is that it just keeps getting more features, that some of which are very experimental. It's a very friendly language in the one sense. In the other sense, it's very large. It seems like if you looked at all the features in a big list, it would be very daunting. So, my talk earlier was about trying to start smaller with it, mm-hmm. and build from there.
It's a good topic. Starting small with F sharp.
Yeah,
that's our topic today.
That's it.
Now, this is interesting. When you say it's immense, are you saying it is immense in its feature set, or is it immense in the sense that it's going to use a lot of those, if I hold down shift and start pushing funky swear word looking characters at the top of the numbers row of my keyboard, that it's going to use more of those in a very terse and uncomfortable way?
No, it doesn't. It's actually very succinct. And part of that's the type inference. Part of that's just flexible syntax. But, it's immense in its feature set. Mm-hmm. There are things that I haven't touched yet. I just haven't had the time. I'm spending time learning how to do certain things with the language, you know, what solve my problem domains at the time, and I don't have time to look at this other giant piece of the language over here.
Mm-hmm.
For example, like computation expressions. This is something that I've not had time to look at. And if there's a Haskell listener, that means that we're talking about monads here in F#. I haven't had an opportunity to look at that. And it's just immense.
One of the things that I have trouble with when I'm learning a new language, whether it be a linguistic language, a human language, or a programming language, is I can get the job done at some point, but I don't know if I said it correctly. Someone said to me once that if you have a friend who says, you know, yeah, I speak 12 languages and I speak them really well. Oh yeah, you know, French, totally speak French. And they say, really, you speak French? You should ask them how to say flush the toilet. And if they maybe hung out in France for 6 weeks on a backpacking trip, they might say something in French like the bowl of toilet, you know, the toilet bowl with the water, pull the, you know, or whatever. They might say something that kind of sounds like and explains the process of toilet flushing, but they don't know the idiomatic specific speech. And apparently in France, it's like pull the chain. Is the idiomatic speech that means flush the toilet. And if you ask in any language, they all have a different way of expressing that. But you couldn't know that unless you lived there and worked. So people will dance around the right way to do that. So when I try to learn a new language like F#, I can express that bowl with the water and then it goes away. I get my point across, but I don't know if I did it right.
Right.
How do I know in F# that it, I mean, the fact that it worked isn't that it was the correct
way. Was it the most elegant way to do it? Was it the most idiomatic way to do it? Is that what you're?
Yeah, I think so. And then with the rise of Ruby, and this notion of the programmer aesthetic and the language aesthetic, I feel, more insecure about my code than ever before. I mean, that's a really uncomfortable thing. And I'll say it again. I feel insecure about my code more now than before because there seems to be an unwieldy amount of peer pressure on behalf of the community, no matter what language they have, about, well, you know, here's a better way that you could have done that, you know. Someone will write something, and then another guy comes out with a C# link expression that, you know, is like 8 characters, and it's unbelievably elegant. It doesn't feel like a really great way to learn a language, and certainly not a very good way to feel good about oneself.
Sure.
How do you know when you're learning F#? Because I would say you're relatively new to this language, right?
Yeah.
How do you know that you got it right? That this was the right way, that the beautiful way? Do you ask around? Do you look at examples? How can a listener jump into this language? Because so often you hear people say, oh, yeah, I've been poking around with F#. I've been poking around with this language. They make it a chapter or two into a book, but they don't really drink deeply of the language and learn how to say flush the toilet.
There's a budding community around F# that will help, that you can go and you can ask questions, and you can see examples of ways to do things. I'll go to the FS Hub, which is a community server that was set up with forums on it that people ask questions. And someone will post a bit of code and say, hey, what's the best way to do this? And then you'll get four different responses,
mm-hmm.
With different styles and different ways to do things. And it's a friendly community, which
okay.
is fun. And you can, and then eventually you'll see one of the implementers of the language will come on and say, oh, no, here's how I can do this really succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's kind of a lot of fun. There's an engagement of people to write elegant, beautiful code with F#, and they're willing to help each other do it. And another resource is that the F# source actually ships with the language. So you can go down the libraries, you can look at elegant ways to do things, to see how the language is built up. You can look at how that F# list is implemented and see that it's in essence written in three lines of code, for example. And it's just, there's a lot of beauty within the libraries themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I didn't realize that since those libraries ship, they would be the canonical example of a good way to do something.
Sure.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down with me. I know that you're missing a session right now, and this was really interesting stuff. Thanks. I think that F# is going to be kind of the new .NET language. I understand it's going to be in Visual Studio. It's supported in a more fundamental way. Are we going to see refactoring tools for F#?
Perhaps. That's kind of a personal goal of mine this year. I don't think I can make any announcements about things, but
yeah.
Know that we are looking very closely at F# for CodeRush and Refactor, support for CodeRush and Refactor, so from DevExpress. So, you know, maybe on the horizon you might see something there.
Fantastic. New language on the horizon, F#. Thank you very much, Dustin, for sitting down with me here at CodeMash. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I'll see you again next week.